Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the Department of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is the third part of episode 35, where we're discussing Arlie Russell Hochschild's The Managed Heart. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. So in part three of episode 35, now we're going to go into a broader theme synthesis of the things that we saw in the book that we believe relate to other kinds of research or podcast episodes and those kinds of things. So why don't you review our thoughts on the main ideas?
Kind of following on at the end of part two, I was struck by the discussion about automation and what effect it is having on emotional labor displacing. Perhaps displacing emotional labor to other things. And it kind of speaks to another way of looking at the exchange of feeling. How do customers feel about the exchange with automation? Very clearly, in my mind, if it's a routine activity, and a routine activity might be defined as something that is capable of being programmed so that a consistent result or a consistent service is achieved, perhaps in those particular cases, there's no need to worry about emotional labor. But there's probably nothing more maddening than getting into using a automated system that is simply not functioning the way that you expect. And it's almost like you're dealing interactively with a person who is withholding the service. And so I just kind of wonder if there's something to be studied from, the book talks heavily from the side of the service provider. How much do we want to focus on the customer's side? And if the customer is expecting or anticipates or needs emotional labor support in doing a transaction, then what is the price of automation? And when is the price of automation too high? Is our cynicism or our frustration with automated systems justified? In some cases, I think we've perhaps are overdoing it to say that our natural reaction whenever we hear an automated system is to immediately start saying operator, like that Discover card commercial.
I have two kind of views of this. The first is that emotional labor seems to be something that machines are perhaps not so good at. And so maybe that's something that now will become more valued. Ellie Hochschild says in her afterword that when she's spoken with nurses, they'll say, do you know what? We have surgeons who act like robots. Their bed manner's terrible. They're not very caring for the patients. It's actually me as a nurse who helps a patient through their illness and helps them recover. And it's through emotional labor that happens. That's what caring involves. And so that makes me hopeful maybe that the professions which rely on emotional labor, which have traditionally been quite female-focused and poorly paid, maybe they will find some more value and will appreciate the value of emotional labor more. So that's sort of, on the one side, some optimism. But then on the other hand, you may or may not have noticed when you log on to, say, a retail site now that you are greeted by a chatbot. And you might not realize that you're talking. Yeah, and sometimes we don't even know we're talking to a robot because they're very competent at feeding back the hellos and pleasantries. And they're programmed to do that. And they don't get upset. They don't snap. They don't burn out. They don't need breaks. So perhaps that emotional labor is starting to be replaced with these chatbots and conversational agents who might actually be better at it in a customer service setting in terms of they're very consistent with the regulation of emotion than humans. So then we're back to the problem of where do we find value for the humanness of work? So I'm torn. I don't know which way I think things will go.
I think those are really interesting research threads to pursue, this idea of how is that like? Obviously, you can't ask the chatbot, but you can – so I think that's another – angle on what Tom was saying, where you look at the receiving end of the customer service and how do they view that emotional, what used to be done, but your emotional work or that interaction. So I think that's a really interesting way to look at it, particularly keeping in the theme of automation. One thing that I was struck about, and I don't know if this I think this would be worthy of researching is this idea when you dial into this help system or you're having this interaction that the employee, so now I'm talking about real humans, they're encouraged and actually trained to tell you that they empathize with your problem. You know, and to me as a technical person, when I'm trying to get a technical answer, I'm not really too interested in whether they empathize with my issue that my screen goes blank, you know, periodically. I want to know what to do. But there's always this pause where they'll say, oh, I understand why that could be really difficult or why that could be painful. But so you can tell they're reading from a script because it happens consistently. And I won't mention the companies that do this. And so I think it would be interesting to research what's it like for them where they have this training to give this sort of automatic empathy, you know, kind of thing. And it's really very thinly veiled as automatic empathy because they're just kind of restating what you said. I wonder what that does for them because I think it's a different angle on the emotional work and the control aspects of the interaction.
Yeah, let me add a thought to that because also, if you're using some of the higher end software or some particular automation packages, and you do get a hold of somebody who's in customer
Many
service,
times, yes.
It's somebody who's coming from overseas often. So I know that India is well known for having or providing customer service for some of these software platforms. And so on top of the script, if you will, there's also just the natural reaction of dealing with somebody who is, you know, distantly remote, who you aren't sure as a customer, not necessarily sure that they understand the situation that you understand. And that can be unnerving for some folks. And I wonder if that, to what extent that's been studied. It's been talked about a lot. It has been talked about a lot, but I'm not sure to what extent it's been studied. Does the recognition that the service Yes. provider is in some way distant from you, culturally or otherwise, affect your response?
Tom, I've actually read some really interesting research by a professor called Samita Raghuram, and she talks about call center workers in India, and it's, again, more from the service provider side, but these call center workers are acutely aware of this issue. And so to overcome it as much as possible, they actually adopt a Western persona. And this is, she actually draws on Hochschild's work. And the interesting phenomenon there is it starts as surface acting, using a name and an accent that makes people feel as though they're calling from the same country that they're being contacted from. But over time, she found that this becomes deep acting, that these personas actually take over the call center worker's sort of local persona, and they want to become this person. So it actually can create then conflict in their home life because they have adopted this alternate persona that then becomes more real to them. This is really fascinating work.
Yeah, that is interesting. One of the things I was thinking about was something else that's been outsourced, but this is more from the emotional work aspect of it. A lot of people don't realize, I read this in it was an article in Wired. I haven't read any scholarly research about this, but it was about the emotional toll it takes on people. So it's not exactly emotional work. It's more of a different way of looking at the emotional work. But the emotional toll it takes on people when they have to review Facebook pictures, I think, and other kind of social media platforms for objectionable material. So one way Facebook knows that people are posting bad pictures is if you or I see it and complain about it. So we send this alert. And I think there's other people. Maybe it's these people who pursue the alerts, or maybe they're just looking at stuff and they look at some pretty grisly images. I mean, just you know, bad stuff or things that would be horrific. And this toll it takes on them emotionally. So it's not quite like Hochschild's work, but I think it's similar in that there's this emotional toll the work takes on you. And so I think that would also be something that would be interesting to research is the nature of work that actually exacts a very high price. In this, people, you know, care nothing about your feelings, but the work is very emotionally draining. So I that's also something I think would be worthy of researching.
Yeah, it's certainly pathologists come to mind that they would be in a similar situation because of who they're, what they're working on. And in effect, they have to they have to get over it when they're dealing with the public after, you know, doing things like doing autopsies and on murdered people. And, it, you know, especially if the person who's been murdered is somebody that identifies in some way with the pathologist, it can be very, very unnerving. And how do you overcome that? That's very interesting.
Ralph, you were mentioning Facebook, and that just made me think that perhaps we're all engaged in a certain kind of emotional labor when we're producing ourselves through these social media platforms.
Oh.
So this is perhaps a modernization of this idea, because the tagline of her book is the commercialization of human feeling. Yes. And where are we seeing that more than on social media? We produce these Instagram feeds or Facebook feeds, very much manufacturing a certain kind of life in the eyes of others, trying to make a certain impression, and then Facebook profits from that. So perhaps that's a new frontier.
I think you're right. I hadn't really thought of it that way until you just said it, but I think that would also be worthy of researching, this idea. You see it this sometimes in what they call, I'm trying to remember what the name for it, it's reality TV, which I think is an oxymoron, right? Because when you put a camera on somebody, it's no longer reality. Somebody was telling me recently where we have this show in the United States where people are looking at homes and comparing amongst them. They have them in the United States and also overseas where they're looking at the homes. And it was recently revealed that the people have already chosen their homes before they do any of the filming. It's all play acting, you know, where they're actually pretending to look at the homes and deciding what they want to go do. And they're having these conversations in front of the camera, and that viewers were upset that this facade of, oh, this is going on in real time, actually had to be manufactured for the 30-minute show or something like that.
Wow, they didn't expect that. They thought it was authentic.
Yeah, because it's reality TV, right? So it's supposed to be just happening. So this idea that I think that many viewers felt let down, that, oh, you mean it's not really authentic? Oh, I mean, you know, it's there's actually some stage management that goes on, and Hochschild uses that metaphor many times, and the idea that the people who are doing emotional work don't get much ability to affect the role and the character that they play and the stage stuff. It's all that is all managed by corporate overseers or supervisors.
That's also been part of the reason why we've seen the rise in what we call YouTube stars, because the types of programs which are being presented on YouTube are being perceived as being far more authentic, because it's a much simpler production of individuals or maybe small groups or what have you, with the camera, you know, iPhone camera or what have you, just pointed at them, talking into the screen or going through those situations. And the presentation of authenticity, or the belief of authenticity that it provides, garnered a lot of viewers who are being turned away from the programmed television, like you say.
Tom, you've just made me think as well, with this premium that we're putting on authenticity, there's a couple of programs I've noticed in Australian corporate companies that go something along the lines of bring your whole self to work. And there's a couple of variations on this. And the idea is that we hide away some part of ourself, like our creative flair or our sportsmanship or something, and we're not bringing it to work. And that's a shame, that we should be our whole selves at work. And so companies are running various programs about showing these other sides of yourself in the workplace under the name of authenticity. Of course, I could be cynical and say that this is the organization trying to control every aspect of your life, including, you know, squeezing every last bit of energy out of some creative pursuit that you may have as a hobby. Is this something that you've seen in the States, or do you have any views on this bring your whole self to work notion?
Yes, I have, but it's not quite that obvious.
The Australians are clearly more direct about this than we are in the States.
But what we do, there's no question that in the line of work that I'm in, that there's a very, very strong melding of your professional and your personal lives. I mean, we say about, as a professional military, we're 24/7, 365 professional. And so there's a lot of ways in which we encourage the melding of the professional and personal life, to bring both together, as not for cynical purposes of trying to enhance image so much as it is to try to build a sense of community and a social bond that's going to help get a fighting force ready for the battlefield. And that's a very, very important point. I think, you know, sometimes we try to, well, showcase our authentic selves, but not necessarily for a clear and well-defined purpose. That's if it's an understood purpose that's connected with the reason for membership in the organization, it's easy to grasp and people will be more authentic, I think.
So this brings us to the end of part 3 of episode 35, where we've been talking about the managed heart. And we have been discussing the broader themes of the work and how it relates to other research and things that we see going on in society, and suggesting some research topics about the nature of emotional work and other occupations besides the ones she's talked about. You could also consider updating the flight attendant analysis, because there have been some changes to the marketplace, but she does address many of those. And what really thing I was left with from the book is this idea that the male and female and power dominance kinds of issues and the way women are treated differently, that actually I thought was very powerful at the end, where she brings that into the conversation that she's been having.
What I definitely took away was that if you're going to undergo some sort of a change in an organization, whether that's the provision of new products or services, change relationships with customers or what have you, you ignore feeling at your peril. There's even in the process of automation, there are going to be feelings and perceptions that are involved. And it's just has to be part of what's considered when coming up with changes to an organization.
I also saw this book as a warning, but more on a personal level. So workers who are being expected to produce certain feelings on command and who are made to feel responsible for other people's emotions are being put under a lot of stress. And I think companies and managers need to really assess carefully what they're asking their workers to do, what they're requiring of them, and whether they're overstepping the boundaries of what is acceptable and also what people are being paid for. So that there is something of a personal self that's left alone and is perhaps not commercialized in the employee-employer relationship.
And that's all for part 3 of episode 35. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or via our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website.